There's a story I very much like, which I hope our American friends are going to forgive me for telling. It concerns a party of Americans who were being shown around the Houses of Parliament by an MP acquaintance of theirs. And they were finding this contact with the cradle of democracy a bit overwhelming. So imagine their excitement when, at one point in their tour, they bumped into Lord Hailsham, splendidly attired in his official regalia as Lord Chancellor. He was walking down one of the corridors towards them, and as he approached, he spotted the leader of the opposition, Mr. Kinnock, coming up behind the American party. Well, wanting to attract his parliamentary colleague's attention for a brief word, he raised his hand and called out, "Kneel!" Whereupon all the American tourists dropped to one knee. Well, of course, the story is totally fictitious. And I tell it not to score one off the Americans here, but really to illustrate to you how incongruous the idea of showing obeisance is to a superior these days. I mean, there was a day when kneeling to the Lord Chancellor would have been a perfectly natural thing to do. But now it's so ridiculous we laugh about it. Of course, the class system is still around, but it's only a pale shadow of what it once was in this country, isn't it? And to give them their due, the Americans have done more than most to undermine that kind of stratification in society. "Whenever I hear a man arguing for slavery," said Abraham Lincoln, "I feel a strong desire to have it tried on him personally." When he said it, it would have been quite a controversial statement, but now, a century and a half later, it's scarcely possible to imagine anybody disagreeing with that sentiment. Equality is our great watchword. If we kneel at all these days, it's only in a context of antiquated ceremonial, with our tongues very firmly in our cheeks. Even when we bow to the Queen, that's just a perfunctory courtesy rather than a sign of genuine subservience, isn't it? Now, today, if we're honest, the man who wins our admiration is the man who never kneels to anybody, whom nobody bosses around, the man who knows his rights and sticks up for them, who asserts himself and won't be patronized. An attitude of servility, which once would have been good manners, is now a badge of contempt in our culture. The very idea of inferior rank, of being somebody's slave, why, that is utterly unacceptable to us. All of which, I fear, is going to make our Bible study this morning rather difficult. In fact, possibly even unpalatable to some amongst us. Because this passage we're looking at is dominated by the ideas of obedience and servanthood. Can there be any picture, do you think, in more stark contrast to the kind of self-assertive spirit of our 20th century society than that of Jesus here in verse 41, praying on the Mount of Olives, "Not my will, but yours be done." And do you notice his posture as he prays that prayer? He's kneeling. Those of you who have been following our series of studies, you will know that in this chapter 22, Luke has brought us very near to the end of the pathway to the cross which Jesus has been following through the pages of this gospel. The conspiracy for Jesus' life has almost closed its jaws upon him. But as we saw last week, Jesus, by clever planning, has secured one last evening in the company of his disciples. And he's using it to give them some vital clues that they need to understand why his death is necessary and what it's going to achieve. Last week we looked at the communion meal which he inaugurated during that last evening he had with them, and thought about how its relationship with the Passover shed light in this respect. Well, now this week we're going to examine a second strand of Old Testament scripture, which Jesus clearly felt was an important pointer towards the meaning of his cross, and which he directs his disciples to on this occasion. Not this time from the book of Exodus, but rather from the book of Isaiah, and in particular from chapter 53 of Isaiah, which we read a bit of earlier on in our service. Scholars agree now that that passage in Isaiah 53 is just one of several poems that the prophet composed, and which are often collectively called the servant songs, because they all focus around the experience and mission of one whom Isaiah repeatedly refers to as the servant of the Lord. Now, at times, this servant seems to be a kind of symbolic figure, representing the people of God as a whole. In one verse, Isaiah says directly, "You are my servant, Israel, in whom I will be glorified." But at other times, this servant seems to assume a much more personal and individual identity, over against the rest of Israel. And that is certainly true in Isaiah 53. Because in that chapter, as we saw earlier, the servant is portrayed as a man rejected, despised by everybody, a man of sorrows, whose judicial murder God turns into an atoning sacrifice for the sins of other people. "We all like sheep have gone astray, but the Lord has laid on him, the servant, the iniquity of us all." Now, it's true Bible scholars do argue a bit about the degree to which that Old Testament passage influenced the mind of Jesus. And it's probably true that some Bible commentators have strained their imagination to find allusions to Isaiah 53 in far more places than you can really substantiate in the Gospels. But I don't think there can be any reasonable doubt that Jesus' intention was to direct his disciples to that particular section of Old Testament prophecy here in Luke 22. Because, you see, he does so not only indirectly when he says in verse 27, "I'm not here as a king. I am among you as one who serves." But he does so also much more explicitly by a verbatim quotation applied directly to himself in verse 37. "It is written, and he was numbered with the transgressors. I tell you, this must be fulfilled in me." If you were listening closely earlier, you'll know that that text, "he was numbered with the transgressors," is a direct quotation from Isaiah 53, verse 12, that we read together. Of course, we've noticed often, haven't we, that sense of compulsion in Jesus as he walks the Via Dolorosa. "The Son of Man must suffer," he says. And we've often been a bit puzzled by it. At last we have the clue to its origin. It is the must of inspired prophecy. Isaiah 53 must be fulfilled in me, he says. That's why the Son of Man must suffer. "For I am that man of sorrows," he says. "I am that atoning sacrifice. I am the one who was numbered with the transgressors. I am the servant of the Lord." And it's against that background of self-identification on Jesus' part with this servant figure that I want us to study these verses in Luke 22 together. And we'll do it in two parts. First of all, I want us to look at verses 24 to 30 to see what they have to say about the meekness of the servant's leadership. And I want us to look at the rest of the passage, 31 to 46, to see what they have to say about the nature of the agony of the servant's prayer. First of all, then, the meekness of servant leadership. Look again at verses 24 and following at the beginning of our passage. "There's a dispute. Which of them is to be the greatest? The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors," says Jesus. "But you are not to be like that. The greatest among you should be like the youngest, and the one who rules like the one who serves. For I am among you as one who serves." And it's popular, I think, to suggest that Jesus' great contribution to ethics was the supremacy he gave to love in interpersonal relationships. And no doubt there is truth in that, but I suspect, you know, that to those who actually lived in the first century, the most novel thing about Jesus was not his emphasis on love at all. As many rabbis held similar things on that score. No, it was the place he gave to humility, which was really revolutionary. See, in the first century, the servant role was no more attractive to them than it is to us in the 20th. Take Greco-Roman society, for instance. They had always idolized the success, the achiever, the victorious general or the victorious athlete. That was what it meant to be worthy of applause. That was what excellence consisted of. A man ought to glory in the defeat, even the humiliation of his opponents. That's what it meant to be a real man. And frankly, first century Jews were not much different from that. Fiercely nationalistic in their upbringing, revolutionary often in their temper, their reaction to the anti-Semitic contempt that they encountered amongst these proud Greeks and Romans was to despise their imperial masters at least twice as intensely as they were despised themselves. "We are Abraham's descendants," they once said to Jesus. "We were never slaves to anybody." And they meant it. The very suggestion of slavery was an affront to Jewish pride. So always round, you see, the world in which Jesus lived didn't even pretend to value humility or servanthood. In their catalogue of character, it was a vice, a despicable sign of weakness. A person ought to be proud of themselves. But again and again, Jesus has overturned this unquestioned assumption of his own culture, as he has taught. "Blessed are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the meek. They shall inherit the earth." Do you remember on one occasion Jesus took a child and set him into the midst of his disciples and said, "Unless you become like little children, you can't enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom." Or there was that other famous occasion, just before this incident in Luke 22, almost certainly, before the meal he just shared with the disciples, when he had taken a towel and, to their intense embarrassment, washed his own disciples' feet. In Middle Eastern culture, the act of a menial. "You call me master and lord," he'd said. "If I, your master, have washed your feet, you should wash one another's feet." But for all this patient teaching, his disciples never seem to have really taken on board what he was saying. And so we find him even now, you see, we find them riddled with rivalry and selfish ambition, disputing which of them would hold the top jobs in the kingdom, which Jesus had just told them was soon to arrive. So yet again, Jesus has to try to show them what Isaiah 53 had taught him. That in the paradoxical topography of heaven, the way up is always down. The kingdom of God is not for those who aspire to be kings, but for those who aspire to be servants. "The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them," he says. "Those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors." There's more than a hint of irony in that last phrase. They call themselves do-gooders, as we would say. That's their PR propaganda image. "But you know," he says, "the sordid egotism that really fuels all that political ambition of theirs. They are tyrants. They know no other way to lead men except by coercion and manipulation and intimidation, whether they use the iron fist or the velvet glove." Nobody's any doubt about the authoritarian nature of their regimes. They are do-gooders in name only. Look after number one, that's their real policy. But you are not to be like that. This is to be the great distinctive of the church, the revolution that surprises the world. You are not to be like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest, and the one who rules like the one who serves. And says Jesus, "I'm not just telling you this, I am exemplifying it. Who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Isn't it the one who serves or who is at table? But I am among you," he says, "as one who serves. In my relationship with you," he says, "haven't you noticed how I have reversed the expected role of rabbi and disciple? I've waited on you at table. I've done the washing up. I've even washed your feet. Soon I'm going to die on a cross. And that too will be an act of service, so that you may have the privilege of sitting at a table at a heavenly banquet. I am among you as one who serves, just as Isaiah said it would be. Well, now it is time for you to learn how to assume that humble dignity yourselves. Because I'm about to go. And you are about to become leaders yourselves. Verse 28, you are those who stood by me in my trials. And I confer on you a kingdom, just as my father conferred one on me, so that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Some people take Jesus' words here quite literally, believe that he's referring to a millennial restoration of the nation of Israel at the end of time. The plausibility of that interpretation hinges on the evidence for such a restoration of a physical Israel, which you find in other parts of the Bible. And some of that is really quite obscure, and we haven't got time to examine it this morning. Suffice it to say that, for myself, I prefer to interpret Jesus here in his promise to the apostles as referring to a symbolic 12 tribes, symbolizing the church. He's promising them a special role, not in some literally reconstituted Jewish nation, but rather in the new Israel, of which they were founder members, the Christian community. As a result, he says, of their unique first-hand experience of him, of being with him in his trials, they would possess unusual authority in the New Testament people of God. Indeed, that was so. So vital a position of leadership did these apostles occupy in the church after Jesus' death, that we even find John in the book of Revelation likening New Jerusalem to a city built on 12 foundations, each of them with an apostle's name on it. But whatever the precise fulfillment of this strange promise in verse 30 is, and you may differ from me on that, the most important thing to notice is really the one in verse 29. Just as my Father conferred on me, he says. Calls to mind another use of that word in John's Gospel, where we read, just as the Father sent me into the world, even so send I you. Jesus is saying there, this kingly role that I am bequeathing to you, to sit on thrones, is identical in its nature to the kingly role God the Father has appointed to me. So it's from me that you, or to me that you are to look for your model of leadership among the people of God, not to the kings of the Gentiles. And I am among you as one who serves. Make sure then, when that authority from which I'm speaking falls upon your shoulders, that servanthood is your leadership style. That's what he said. It's hard to overestimate the importance of that instruction, I think, or the damage to the church that has resulted from its neglect. See, one of the problems in this world is the only way to gain power is to be a pusher. Isn't that true? The meek man doesn't win elections. It's the aggressive, the ruthless, the conceited man so often. The man who grabs at power and won't let go. That's the type who comes out on top in our world so often. And that's tragic, because it means that those most fit to rule by virtue of their integrity and their selflessness are rarely given the opportunity to rule. Nobody was ever fitter to be a king than Jesus, but they put him on a cross, not on a throne. And all too often that is where good men finish up in our world. Jesus is telling us here, it shouldn't be like that in the church. The church should be different from the world. But I fear all too often the sorry tale of the church down through history is that she has simply been a mirror to the passing political fads of her day when it comes to her pattern of government and leadership. Under imperialism, she adopted universal papacy. Under monarchy, she opted for nationalistic episcopalianism. When democracy stirred, lo, the church discovered congregationalism. And I'm tempted to add that the implicit anarchism, which has characterized a lot of 20th century thinking, is not unrelated to the emergence of anti-clerical and unstructured forms of house fellowship today. It's to our shame the church has so often taken its cue from the kings of the Gentiles rather than from the King of Glory. He's told us the type of leadership he wants. It is, he says, the type of leadership he represented. I am among you as a servant. Why do we find that such a role so uncongenial? I'm not speaking the truth when I say it's because deep down we feel so insecure. As if the kingdom Jesus speaks of was something we must grab at, something we must achieve. No, he says, I confer this kingdom on you. Why do you have to have a dispute about who's going to be greatest? I'm bequeathing this kingdom to you. You don't have to struggle for it. You don't have to fight for top place. And that knowledge should free you from the necessity of aggression and self-assertion. Should free you to be humble. Should free you to serve. See, no resentment festers in my heart, he says, that God calls me the servant. No bitterness that this indignity should be foisted on me, son of God that I am. There's no wounded pride in me, no indignant fist. Why then should there be among you? I'm among you as one who serves. God is looking today, I'm quite sure, for people who've learned that lesson from Christ. Who've learned the greatness of servanthood. And how it will alter our understanding to our lives, to our ambitions, to leadership. It will change the way we seek leadership, won't we? Won't it? I mean, if we are wise, we will be suspicious, won't we, of the pushy type who volunteers himself for office. Aren't the best leaders more likely to be those who are reluctant to accept authority, who feel themselves unworthy of it, who dislike the public prominence into which it thrusts them? Aren't best leaders, at least in the church, likely to be those who refuse promotion if they can, on the grounds that whilst it may increase their prestige, it may diminish their ministry? Now, Professor Henry Drummond, in the last century, great intellectual of his day, was urged by Gladstone, the Prime Minister, to stand for Parliament. And he refused, because he said the spiritual work he was doing as a humble minister in Scotland was more important. What Jesus is saying here too will change the way we accept leadership, won't it? We won't feel piqued when others are elected in our place. We won't object to playing second fiddle, will we? We won't be found forever whining about our rights, or plotting rebellion amongst the malcontents. Now, the servant has no pride to be wounded, no ego to be threatened. Like John the Baptist, the humble man will be content to say of his colleague, he must increase, but I must decrease. And feel no shame, no failure in such a confession. And what Jesus says here about servanthood, won't it change the way we exert leadership too? Doesn't it transform our notion of power? The rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, he says. You know, John F. Kennedy was once asked why he wanted to be president, and he replied, because that's where the power is. And it's a fair enough answer, I suppose. Power can be used for good. But I wonder if he was really right to think that power could be located in the office of the White House. For Jesus never won an election. Jesus never sat on a throne. He never commanded an army. The only crown he ever wore was made of thorns. The only palace he ever entered was as a prisoner. Now, can you tell me of any president, any king, any general who's influenced the world more than he has? And he has done it not by the whip of political or military might. He's done it from the cross. We follow a crucified king. And a crucified king threatens nobody, oppresses nobody, coerces nobody. His is a leadership which is offered to free men. Men whose self-determination is not robbed. Political power doesn't do that. Political influence, even of the most democratic kind, is always implicitly coercive. The rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. But that isn't Jesus' style. That isn't what Jesus means by power. And how the world would be changed, how the church would be changed, if only we could learn from him. that true greatness does not consist in being a king, but in being a servant. The meekness of the servant's leadership. That's the first thing we have to think about this morning. It has all kinds of applications in our lives that we just can't keep on talking about, or we go on all day. The second thing I want you to look at, though, is in the second half of the passage. And it's the agony of the servant's prayer, not unrelated to what we've just been saying. Look on to verses 39 and 42 for the moment. Jesus went out as usual to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples followed him. On reaching the place, he said to them, "Pray that you will not enter into temptation." And he withdrew about a stone's throw beyond them, knelt down and prayed, "Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done." Now, there's something quite extraordinarily compelling, isn't there, about this scene? I don't know if you, like me, feel you're almost on holy ground when you come to these verses in the Gospels. It's quite clear that this final prayer that Jesus prayed on earth was like no quiet time you or I will ever have. He was no stoic, you see. Like iron against the tension of the situation. No, this was a torture for him. He was in anguish, we read in verse 44. Luke wants us to sense the torture that he experienced as he was praying this prayer. The physical and emotional strain, for a start. So much that an angel from heaven has to strengthen him. And the sweat pours from his body like drops of blood. So embarrassed was some pious scribe in the early church by this evidence of human weakness on Jesus' part that he quietly cut verses 43 and 44 out of his copy. That's why some manuscripts don't have them. But there's no serious doubt, I think, about the authenticity of these words. Jesus was locked in inner spiritual struggle, and it drained his physical and his emotional resources to the point of utter exhaustion. Maybe you have been under stress at some time in your life. Maybe you've even had a nervous breakdown. Well, Jesus knows what it's like to reach the bottom of your human resources like that, to have nothing more to give. But Luke wants us to be aware too, I think, of the utter loneliness Jesus felt as he wrestled in this way in prayer. You see, that stone's throw distance that he withdrew from the disciples, I think that's almost a symbolic kind of phrase there. Jesus was out on his own. That alienation, that lack of real support from his friends is something that comes out again and again in this whole second half of our passage. It starts, for instance, with what he says about Peter in verses 31 and following. "Simon, Satan has asked to sift you as wheat," he says. "But I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And when you've turned back, strengthen your brothers." "I'm ready to go with you to prison and death," says Simon Peter. Jesus answered, "I tell you, before the cock crows, you will deny three times that you know me." We're going to think about what happened to Peter on this last day of Jesus' life in a bit more detail next week. So we shall come back to this verse then. But for today, I want you to look at what these verses meant. Not for Peter himself, but for Jesus. Of course, his threefold denial was a devastating humiliation for the disciple. But think too what a devastating disappointment it must have been for the master. From the beginning of his ministry, from those 40 days in the wilderness, right at the very beginning after he was baptized, Jesus had been in contest with Satan. And for the vast majority of that time, he had enjoyed human companionship, the emotional support of these 12 friends. That's why he says in verse 28, "You are those who've stood by me in my trials." That meant a lot to him. But you notice the tense is now past. The days of camaraderie are over. Satan has desired to sift you. The disciples' allegiance was under demonic attack. Just as he had done with Job, Satan had come before the Lord to accuse them. These aren't real Christians, he said. They're just fair-weather friends of Jesus. Let me turn the heat on and you'll see their faith fall apart. And extraordinarily, God had said, okay, put them through your sieve, Satan. See if you can expose chaff among my wheat. And already he's secured a notable success, hasn't he? Judas, the turncoat, he's even now preparing to betray his master with a kiss. Soon Satan would turn his attention on the rest of them. And every one of them would be seized with panic, forsake him, flee. Even Peter. Yes, brave, devoted, confident Peter. The rock, they called him. But he would be about as substantial as a pile of sand when the test came. I'm ready to go with you to prison and to death, he says. You're wrong, Peter. You vow too much and you'll live to regret it. You overestimate your strength. Brave though you think you are, before the night is out, you will despise yourself for your cowardice. Devoted to me though you think you are, before the night is out, you will wail with self-reproach at your disloyalty to me. Confident though you think you are, before the night is out, you will blush with shame at your failure. Prison and death you'll endure for me, will you, Peter? If only you knew yourself a little better, you'd realize that a serving girl's gossip is all that it will take to make a liar of you. But Peter's problem wasn't just that he overestimated his own strength. Luke goes on to make it clear that he'd also underestimated the nature of the trial that was about to descend on him and upon all the rest of the disciples. Look at verse 35. Then Jesus asked them, "When I sent you without purse, bag, or sandals, did you lack anything?" "Nothing," they answered. He said to them, "But now, if you have a purse, take it. And also a bag. And if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one." Jesus is disabusing them of their illusions here. He's reminding them of one of the high spots of their time together, one of those good times, recorded in Luke 10, when he had sent them out with a number of others into the villages of Galilee to preach the kingdom and to heal the sick. And how they came back rejoicing in the power they had been given over the forces of evil on that occasion. "I saw Satan fall," he says, "like lightning from heaven." And of course, as Jesus reminds them of that, they instinctively feel, great, it's going to be like that again. Of course, we don't have to worry. We didn't have to worry then. But says Jesus, listen, things are different now. Times have changed. Satan has recovered from that temporary fall and is now on the ascendant. Then you went out without money in your purse or food in your bag. All you needed was met by the generosity of the people. You went out unarmed because you felt completely safe. No one desired to hurt you. You were the popular disciples of a popular Christ. Then, that says Jesus, this is Satan's moment. This is the hour when darkness reigns. And you will find that my popularity has dissolved. And yours with it. Liberality will give way to ostracism, approbation to hostility, patronage to violence. You'll need to provide for yourselves now. You'll need to defend yourselves now. The time for relying on the world's hospitality and the world's protection is over. We are all in for a lonely time. You and me both. So he that has a purse, take it, and also a bag. And if you don't have a sword, you better get one. For it is written, he was numbered with the transgressors. And I tell you, this must be fulfilled in me. Of course, controversy has raged around Jesus' mention of a sword there. The medieval popes even used this text to defend their policy of converting the pagans by military conquest. But it's quite certain Jesus meant nothing of that kind. He clearly wasn't encouraging his disciples here to literally take up arms against their enemies. That would have been contrary to the whole tenor of his teaching about turning the other cheek. And of course, when they did actually try to do that, as we read in verse 49, a bit further down the page, Jesus rebuked them and healed the injury that they had inflicted in their hasty violence. So it's clear Jesus wasn't intending to be taken literally about this sword. Most commentators assume Jesus is using what's called hyperbole, that is, exaggerated language. It's quite common amongst Jews. And he's using it to press home the point he wants to make very forcibly, that this swing in public opinion against him and those who are identified with him is going to be a very acute one. In fact, we might say, better get your holster on, because you're in for dangerous times. And that interpretation may very well be right, but there is another possibility, and it's worth thinking about. And that is that Jesus isn't using hyperbole here so much as a peculiarly intense form of irony, almost bordering on sarcasm. See, he links verse 37 to verse 36. Sell your cloak and buy a sword, for it is written, he was numbered with the transgressors. In other words, the prophet says the suffering servant would be identified with a load of criminals. Well, the time has come for you to dress up for the part. Arm yourselves like brigands. Yes, why not? You might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb. Then I shall really be numbered among the transgressors, all right. The tragic thing is whether Jesus was speaking in this hyperbolic way or ironically. The disciples failed totally to discern it. They interpreted him in the most wooden and literal way possible. As if he really did mean them to make military preparations for a coup d'etat. See, Lord, here are two swords, they say. No wonder Jesus could only sigh with resignation. It's enough. So blind, you see, to the real nature of the conflict he's talking about. What's the use of talking further? You don't understand. How could you understand? This battle that I'm about to fight can't be won with swords, even if we had a million of them and warriors to wield them. It's a spiritual battle. And you disciples, though I know you love me so much, you can't help me win it. I'll pray for you, Peter. But which of you will pray for me? The answer is nobody. The disciples, we discover in the next verses, are so shattered, they can't even stay awake long enough to pray for themselves, let alone Jesus, in the hour of his greatest crisis. Now, this last battle, this last agony, was single combat. Jesus is fighting solo, a stone's throw from his disciples. Father, he says, if you are willing, take this cup from me. Yet not my will. Yours be done. It's clear there was a choice facing Jesus as he kept that lonely vigil on the Mount of Olives, isn't it? In fact, it was a choice that had confronted him repeatedly ever since his baptism. Which path shall I walk? The path of self-assertion? Or the path of self-surrender? Shall I make it my ambition to be a king? Or a servant? It's important to understand that Jesus, incarnate Son of God though he was, had a psychological identity separate from his Father. He could distinguish his will from the Father's will. In fact, in a way strangely parallel to Adam in the Garden of Eden, we see Jesus here in the Garden of Gethsemane, presented with the option of disobedience. There was nothing stopping him seeking an easier way for himself. He had the power not only to avoid the cross, but to vanquish his enemies by force, if he wished. But unlike Adam, he resisted the temptation to make a bid for such power. He used those words of Paul we spoke earlier. He didn't count equality with God something to be grasped at. No. He took the role of servant. And he was obedient. Not my will, but yours be done. What do you think was in that cup that he speaks about? That he shrank from it so violently. Father, if it's possible, take this cup from me, he says. Was it suffering and death, do you think? Is that what he saw as he looked into that cup he was about to drink? But then many a Christian has suffered and died under torture, just as appalling as crucifixion. And many of them have met that fate with cheerfulness and triumph. Now, as Jesus looked into that cup, there must have been more there than mere suffering, mere death. It was sin he saw there. He was the servant, remember. And the servant was one upon whom the Lord laid the iniquity of us all. What he saw in that cup was the wrath of God against an evil world. He who had never known what alienation from God meant, so intimate was his relationship with his Father ever since childhood, he would experience in that cup not just the agony of being separated from friends and family, he would experience the agony of hell, of judgment. No loneliness this world has ever known can equal the alienation he felt as he cried, my God, why have you forsaken me? And it was here in the garden, secretly, that he made the choice, the critical, final choice, to go that way. It was here he prayed the prayer of the servant. Not my will, yours be done. And I'm here this morning to tell you that that is the prayer God is waiting to hear from each one of us. This mind that was in Jesus, this humble mind, this servant mind, that's the mind God wants to see formed in us. The same choice essentially confronts you and me as confronted him. Self-assertion or self-surrender. Rebellion or obedience. The ego trip or servanthood. See, we have a will too. And we may align it with God's or against God's. I'm quite sure Satan today, as every day, is sifting us to see if he can't make sure that servant prayer never passes our lips. I think many of us misunderstand temptation. You know? We think it's concerned only with occasional slips in our moral behaviour. It's not so. It's our spiritual destination the devil is primarily concerned with. The direction of our lives. He's quite happy to see us have victory in little matters. If he achieves his purpose when we have to make that big, that critical decision about the servant's prayer. He's not isolated acts of goodness he's afraid of. What throws him into terror is the prospect of lives committed to obedience. That's what destroys his rule in this world, you see. People who give up their rebellion and kneel to God. So he didn't mind what Jesus did with his life. Jesus could have done anything he liked. So long as he could sow a seed of rebellion against the Father's will in Jesus' heart, then no matter how kind or philanthropic or loving Jesus might be, the campaign belonged to Satan. It is the same with us. He doesn't mind what sort of a nice person you are. He doesn't mind what sort of lofty, philanthropic, humanitarian ambitions you have for your life. Just so long as you don't pray, not my will, yours be done. He's happy. All his cunning, all his craft and might, all his intimidation is directed against us making such a decision. Every diversionary tactic in the book, I imagine, is being implemented right at this moment to stop us thinking about such a thing. The prospect of surrendering our lives to the rule of God and praying that servant prayer for ourselves. Think of all the things you could do with your life, he's telling you. Whatever you do, don't make it your ambition to be a servant of God. Don't yield your will to his. Don't listen to that Jesus. Your life won't be your own anymore if you do that. He'll make you suffer, you know. Look what happened to him. Oh, you come and join us in hell. In hell we're free. We're independent in hell. The one principle of hell is, I am my own. I serve nobody but myself. That's what it's all about in hell. And there, on the other hand, is Jesus. With the marks of nails in his hands, saying, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. And to give his life a ransom for many. Take up your cross and follow me. And today, that choice is ours too. Let's pray together.